Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The river fire burning in Nevada and Placer counties got off to a ferocious start yesterday afternoon. Thousands of residents were forced to evacuate yesterday in the area near Colfax, that's north of I-80. As of this morning, dozens of homes and structures are destroyed. The wildfire is 0% contained, and all of these numbers are preliminary, as this is just a very fluid situation, and these numbers will change. Today, a red flag warning is in place, which means windy conditions coupled with low humidity and critically dry fuels. We have a CAL FIRE River Fire Incident Commander live for us providing an update. Jim Hudson is on the line with the latest information. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Thank you.
Jim, what is the latest update for our listeners on where the fire is exactly burning?
Yeah, as of this morning, the river fire is 2,400 acres. It is burning actively still in both Nevada and Placer counties. The dividing line, the county break there, is the Bear River, and it is burning on both sides of the Bear River. The Placer County side, or what we would call the right flank of the fire, is burning towards the northeast and has come around the west end of the city of Colfax, but it has not directly affected the city limits and is burning towards the Rawlins Lake Reservoir. On the Nevada County side, it is burning along Dog Bar Road and with in the area south of Grass Valley and is burning up towards Highway 174 and the areas of Paradale Chicago Park.
What was the fire activity overnight, and what are the concerns about the weather today?
The fire activity did subside a little bit last night as the smoke laid in and we had some cooler temperatures and we had a wind reversal that was not as significant. The concerns for today is as far as weather patterns, we are looking at a mirror image of yesterday as far as the low RH, high temperatures, and southwest flow winds that could gust up to 18 miles an hour today. So the key will be today is as the winds start to surface in the early afternoon, being prepared for that, having a fire line established that we're currently working on and having contingency line out ahead of the fire.
You mentioned that the Bear River essentially kind of cuts through the Placer and Nevada County lines. Today, in what direction is the wildfire burning?
The fire is basically burning towards almost due north as you look at the map. It's aligned with the drainage that runs to the northeast, and it is burning to the northeast towards Rawlins Lake Reservoir. And then where it has spotted over the Bear River, it is primarily running due north is the main direction, but it will catch a drainage or a tributary and start to funnel through those areas in some locations.
We know that there are a lot of homes in that area. Is access a challenge?
There are a lot of homes in that area. You know, it is a rural area, but we do have good road systems in there. Access to the structures has not been much of a challenge at all. It is, you know, really just keeping up with the rapid fire spread has been the biggest challenge that we had yesterday. The fire was spotting ahead of itself, throwing firebrands and igniting new fires out ahead of itself. At one point, we had a spot fire approximately 2 miles to the north of the fire.
Mm-hmm. You know, we mentioned that the fire is currently 0% contained. What exactly does that mean?
For the fire to be contained is what basically once we get fire line established and are able to get in there and cool the edges with firefighting personnel, with hose lays and spraying water to cool those edges and get us some depth of what we call black or burned areas and black line, then we will call a certain percentage of that or section of that fire percentage contained. Right now we are establishing control lines, but we're working to get hose around the fire still. And once we're confident that the fire will not spot out or roll out of that area, we will call that percentage containment.
Are the weather conditions favorable to have an air attack planned for today?
Yes, we will have aerial firefighting units above our fire today, both fixed-wing air tankers and with air attack, as well as a combination of assorted types of helicopters, water-dropping helicopters.
As of yesterday and overnight, I mean, we became aware that there are thousands of people that are evacuated. What are the latest evacuation numbers, and has anything changed when it came to orders and warnings?
Yeah, the orders and warnings have not changed since last night. Between both counties, there's approximately 5,200 people that are either in an evacuation order or a warning. at this time.
What's the difference between an order and a warning?
An order is we work with our, you know, as the fire department, we look at the areas and deem what, and looking at the fire behavior, the direction, rate of spread, and the complexity of that area, and we will recommend an area be under an evacuation order. Then that's conducted by the local law enforcement. On this particular fire, we are in unified command with the Nevada County Sheriff's Office and the Placer County Sheriff's Office. So that is an order means you need to leave. And then an evacuation warning is you need to be prepared to leave. If you look at the CAL FIRE website, Ready, Set, Go program, you know, having your go bag, having your kit, and being ready to leave at a moment's notice.
Obviously, this is a very fluid situation, and these numbers will change, as we said at the top of this show. But any idea on repopulation when people might be able to go back home?
Today, we do not anticipate any repopulation. It'll be reassessed this evening. But right now, with the conditions that we have, it's not safe to put residents back in their homes at this time.
What damage has been caused? We already know that dozens of homes and structures have been destroyed.
Yeah, so as far as structures either damaged or destroyed, the damage inspection has begun this morning with the fire activity yesterday and the rapid rate of spread, followed by nightfall and heavy smoke conditions. Damage assessment was a challenge last night, so that is in full swing today. Probably looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 structures possibly destroyed. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean all residents. It could be uninhabitable outbuildings, a barn, a shed. And then we have also reports of 20 additional structures that have been confirmed damaged but not destroyed. And those numbers will become solidified, and we'll have a better update this evening as the damage inspection has begun this morning.
How are firefighters on the ground doing? Any injuries? Is everyone staying safe?
Yeah, for the most part, we were doing very good. Firefighters are working hard, very proud of them. Our CAL FIRE firefighters, our cooperating agency firefighters from the local governments around the area. We did have one minor burn injury yesterday of a firefighter who was treated and released. And we had two minor civilian burns that were transported to the hospital yesterday.
Yeah, as we know, this wildfire season is already strong, and we've had more wildfires this year compared to last year. Were crews pulled off the Dixie Fire, which is relatively nearby in Plumas County, to help with the river fire? I mean, just checking in on staffing overall.
We did get a few what we would call overhead, fire line leadership type personnel or personnel that are able to assist within our incident base as far as strike teams of engines or dozers or hand crews. Nothing has been pulled off the Dixie yet. We were able to utilize our regional system to get resources here as quick as possible.
Finally, I understand that this is very early on. The focus is on containing this fire, but any preliminary info on a potential cause?
At this point, the cause and origin of the fire is under investigation, and we'll follow up when we have more details.
Okay. CAL FIRE Incident Commander Jim Hudson, thank you so much for taking the time and updating us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're updating the River Fire, which is burning in Placer and Nevada counties. The wildfire started near Colfax yesterday afternoon. Thousands of residents remain evacuated. Dozens of homes and structures are destroyed. And the wildfire currently has 0% containment. We're joined now by CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd, who joins us live from the area following the river fire. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
You just finished a press briefing updating the river fire. What stood out to you?
Well, just the anticipation of today being a crucial day for trying to get this fire under control. As you said, yesterday, the fire really did take off. Overnight, it grew by another 1,000 acres. And with it 0% contained, this today is a pivotal moment that was also discussed at the incident management briefing as well. So just that viewing today as crucial to make sure that the fire gets under control and they can start bringing folks back from the evacuation orders.
Yeah, as you start to get a lay of the land, what are you seeing and what are you hearing from people?
I still have not spoken to any evacuees just because I've been at the incident management briefings and the press briefing all morning. But among, firefighters, it seems like morale is up. It seems like, they know that today will be a tough day just with the conditions that are out there. But there seems to be optimism that hopefully with conditions not getting too bad, they'll be able to make some good progress on this fire.
And Colfax is just north of Auburn. And, if you're going east on I-80, for a lot of people, if they're going to North Tahoe, you pass through Colfax. You actually went through the archives. You found kind of a poignant coincidence. It was kind of ironic with the governor in Colfax when he just became governor.
That's right. The first full day that Governor Gavin Newsom entered office, he held a press briefing at the Cal Fire station in Colfax. And he talked about what he wanted to do with wildfires and how there needed to be a significant change in course with how the state handled fires. Here's what he had to say.
We still have organized so much of the bureaucracy of government around a world that no longer exists, around a fire season that no longer exists. We staff up, we staff down, and now we're reacting to these old mores, and that fundamentally has to change. In the last few years, I think substantive progress has been made in the state of California. The legislature and former Governor Brown, I think did a very good job in the last few years leaning into these issues, but it's clear to me a lot more needs to be done.
And, we can discuss at length, probably fill a whole episode with, what successes or shortcomings the Newsom administration has had on fighting wildfires, but the fact that this fire is burning so close to where he held that first press briefing of his governorship, and the fact that so many homes are threatened right now in a year that's expected to be a very bad fire season. It already is a very bad fire season. That is a reflection of that this crisis isn't going anywhere.
And just on that note, this isn't the first wildfire you have covered this season. Where are we at when it comes to 2021 compared to previous years?
So last year, over 4 million acres burned. That was the most on record in California. As of late July last year, about 120,000 acres had burned statewide. Through late July of this year, over, I believe it was 400,000 acres had burned. So a significant increase from where we were last year to where we are this year. So there's a lot of concern. There are extreme conditions out there. Fuel moisture levels are very low. We're continuing to see heat waves. We're continuing to see extreme weather conditions that make it very difficult to fight these fires. We have the sixth largest fire in state history burning up in the Butte County area with the Dixie Fire. It grew by 50,000 acres overnight. A 50,000 acre fire in general would be big. This fire grew by 50,000 acres to 320,000 acres. And we're only in August. Peak fire season typically is, late September and into October, into November. So we are still early on in this fire season, and we're seeing some serious blazes.
Yeah, it's important to remember the Camp Fire was in November. The Thomas Fire in Southern California was in December. Going back to the Dixie Fire, that is still in our area. That's near Lake Almanor. The community of Greenville largely destroyed. You mentioned that this wildfire is more than 300,000 acres, and it started 3 weeks ago. And I think that's just so sobering, given that, they're still working on containment and kind of an ominous foreshadowing of what's in store.
Absolutely. The Dixie Fire is at 35% containment. They have been making some progress, but just conditions, I can't emphasize it enough, conditions are so extreme out there. I've talked to folks who are currently and formerly in Cal Fire, and they say, the last 5-10 years have just been so different from what firefighting looked like before, and even in the last couple years. And just conditions make it so much harder to contain fires, so much harder to jump on them more proactively. They spread quicker, and efforts at prevention, such as fuel breaks and fuel management, they're less effective when crews are facing this level of extreme conditions.
Hmm. Finally, I know that we've been talking about how you've been covering wildfires already this season. I know you just got to Colfax, but how is this terrain different from others that you've covered recently? Because, you know, some wildfires are in very rural areas where homes are very far apart. And Colfax has a good amount of a dense community when you're looking at Placer and Nevada counties.
It is a dense community. The incident commander earlier today said that there are 3,400 structures that are threatened. Many or most of them are homes or residences. So that indicates a pretty densely populated area as far as a forested or, you know, urban wildland interface area goes. You know, some things are similar to other fires I've seen, such as, you know, there's pretty rugged terrain out here. There's some steep ridges, there's some steep, you know, foothills. And so fighting fire in that terrain gets very tricky, gets very tough. You can't bring in equipment like you can for, you know, more, for sort of flatter land, so to speak. You know, when you're dealing with steep, rugged terrain, you're often having people hike in, and that's a drain on crews, a drain on resources, and it just makes it much harder to fight the fires.
Scott, thanks for joining us with an update.
Thank you.
And that is CAP Radio's Scott Rodd covering the River Fire. You can stay up to date on this wildfire and other wildfires burning throughout California on capradio.org. And you can follow those updates throughout the day. Up next, a recap of the first and perhaps the only governor recall debate with CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Well, the first and possibly only debate for the recall election of Governor Gavin Newsom was held last night. Four Republican candidates, John Cox, Kevin Falconer, Kevin Kiley, and Doug Ose, accepted the invitation from Fox 11 in Southern California to face off in a debate. Governor Newsom, Larry Elder, who is currently leading in the polls, and Caitlyn Jenner were also invited to the debate, but Fox 11 said they declined. We're going to get an update on how the debate went, as well as how the campaigns are going and which candidate is leading in the polls. Joining us now to break it all down for us is CAP Radio's politics reporter and California State of Mind podcast co-host, Nicole Nixon. Nicole, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm sure most of us remember the debate between President Biden and former President Trump, where the candidates, I mean, just talked over each other and yelled and all that stuff and name calling. Can you give us a little explainer, kind of set the atmosphere of what happened during this debate?
Yeah, you know, I also flashed back to that presidential debate last night because this one was not like that at all. Candidates were very respectful of each other. They were respectful of their time allotments. There were very few attacks against other Republicans, not even Larry Elder or Caitlyn Jenner, the two Republicans who weren't there. The only punching bag in this debate was Gavin Newsom.
Well, with that said, I mean, we know they're all kind of unified in their criticism of the governor, but did the candidates actually do anything to differentiate themselves from one another?
You know, policy-wise, they tried. I think their personalities were more of the differentiating factors last night. So I would say that Kevin Falconer, the former San Diego mayor, he had some of the most well-thought-out responses to policy questions, and he was also able to talk about how he worked with Democrats during his time as mayor. He focused on making California more affordable. Let's take a listen.
I put forward the largest tax cut in California history for our middle class because we need it, because our state's too expensive and Californians are leaving and voting with their feet.
He used that voting with their feet, leaving California line a few times. Doug Ose, a former congressman from the Sacramento area, he had some good zinger lines in the debate last night. At one point, he was talking about EDD, the state's unemployment agency, and he said it shouldn't be so hard for them to, and I'm quoting here, answer the damn phone. Assemblyman Kevin Kiley, he talked really fast. It was really hard even for me to follow what he was saying half the time. He showed, though, that he has deep knowledge of how the legislature works, how government works, but I think that message was kind of clouded by his delivery. And then finally, John Cox, he hasn't really changed his tactics from when he was running against Newsom in 2018, and he lost that race. He did tease an announcement coming today for a 25% income tax cut for every Californian. But I think Cox really played to a segment of the GOP base. He said that people who had COVID shouldn't get the vaccine because they already have antibodies, he argues. And he said that he wants the wall along the border with Mexico to be finished.
When it comes to the topic of homelessness, that is top of mind for many Californians, and the governor has faced his fair share of criticism. That was also brought up during the debate. What were some of the things that the candidates and challengers were saying?
A few weeks ago, John Cox said that he would support conservatorships and he would support compelling people on the streets into treatment for mental health problems or for addiction. That raised some eyebrows at the time, but other candidates, judging by last night, have pretty much gotten on board with that idea. The idea of compelling people into treatment came up a few times. The candidates also really slammed Newsom and slammed the state strategy on homelessness. They're painting it as this mess of bureaucratic departments that are spending a lot of money and not really communicating with each other. And there is some reporting out there to suggest there's some truth to that. This is a topic that Doug Ossie in particular got really heated on. Let's listen to that.
What we're doing isn't working. We need to change. We need to get treatment for the drug addicted. We need to get treatment for the mentally ill. We need to stop calling failure success.
I mean, the governor and also Democratic leaders would say the same thing. But did Doug Ossie or any of the other candidates have specifics about how they would accomplish that? Because it's a very nuanced, complicated issue.
Totally. And I think, like we heard in that quote again, that getting people into treatment is kind of the first step for them, I think.
Well, the legislature is a Democratic majority. And, you know, Kevin Kiley himself is in the legislature as a Republican, of course. Did the candidates say how they would try to work with their counterparts should they win the recall election?
Yeah, there were some pretty interesting responses to this question. Ossie said that he would call up Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez, Democrat from San Diego, and he would figure out how to work with her because he said that she's the most powerful legislator in the Capitol, never mind, you know, the Assembly Speaker or the Senate pro tem. Kevin Kiley, who is a lawmaker in the Republican superminority, laid out his strategy.
I know that the one thing legislators respond to is political pressure, the fear of losing their job. And having just seen the governor lose his job, there will be a unique opportunity to bring fundamental reforms on issues like the cost of living, rising crime rates, and school choice.
And, Kiley talked a few times about what he called the broken system in California politics. He says people in the Capitol serve special interests over their constituents. That's been one of his main messages, and he wants to focus on turning that around.
Well, you're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon about the latest in the recall against Governor Gavin Newsom. Well, let's move on from the debate to, you know, a small win for Governor Newsom's campaign earlier this week. A judge denied a petitioner's request to remove mentions of Republicans and Trump from Newsom's argument in the voter guide. What significance does this have?
Yeah. Okay. So let me explain what kind of was going on here. So Newsom has clearly been labeling the effort to recall him the Republican recall. He's been painting it as this partisan effort, this power grab backed by supporters of President Donald Trump. Now, organizers of the recall filed a lawsuit to try to block Newsom from making those arguments, from tying the recall to the GOP in the state voter guide. This is something that goes out to every voter along with their ballot. Newsom and the recall organizers, they each get, I think, a 500-word argument to put in the voter guide to make their case of why the governor should or shouldn't be recalled. Newsom, in that argument, is, you know, laying out his case that this is a partisan power grab, basically. So they filed a lawsuit to try to block him from mentioning those things. Yesterday, a Sacramento Superior Court judge, in a tentative ruling, she sided with Newsom. She said that not all, but many recall supporters clearly are Republicans and Republican voters. And she said that their legal challenge didn't prove that Newsom was lying or misleading voters by saying that in the voter guide.
Well, with that, how is the governor's campaign going so far? I mean, who exactly is helping him and supporting him?
So Newsom is raising a lot of money. I think he's sitting on something like $17 million right now. A huge chunk of that is coming from labor unions. He recently got a $250,000 check from Democratic donor George Soros. And on the campaign front, Vice President Kamala Harris has said that she will campaign for Newsom. We're also seeing more ads featuring Democratic elected officials nationally. Senator Elizabeth Warren had a new ad that started last week. Again, she's calling it a Republican recall, partisan power grab. And Senator Alex Padilla, who was recently appointed to that seat by Newsom, he also has some Spanish language ads running for Newsom as well.
We know that Larry Elder is currently leading in the polls, but is there a significant lead? What are the polls showing when it comes to his challengers?
Yeah, Larry Elder does have a pretty significant lead. I don't have all the latest exact numbers, but a handful of recent polls have put him pretty clearly in the front of the pack of Republican potential replacement candidates. I think that is significant because he came into this race late. He kind of cruised in, almost didn't even make it on the ballot, but here he is rising to the top. He's got a big base of fans for his radio show. For Newsom, things are looking pretty tight for Newsom. Those recent polls have put the possibility that he is recalled within striking distance, within like a margin of error and within this small percentage of voters who are still undecided. And Republican voters are more engaged. They're more likely than Democrats and independent voters to vote in this election. So the governor needs to get his base riled up if he wants to turn those numbers around.
You know, it's kind of crazy just to think that we're a little over a month from Election Day and a lot can happen between now and September. I mean, we have wildfires burning. There's obviously the situation that's continuing to evolve with COVID and the Delta variant. I mean, what are the overarching challenges the governor is facing as we head closer to that recall Election Day?
I think those two things are the big ones. He's facing a recall, but he's also got these governing challenges kind of licking at his heels. There's this Delta variant is no joke. Cases are going up again, which is the last thing he wants, and he's trying to get more people vaccinated. I think responding to wildfires could potentially take up a lot of time, a lot of his time and energy in the coming weeks as we get closer to this recall.
Logistically, a lot has to happen as well. When can people expect their ballots?
It's a good question. Ballots will be mailed and start hitting mailboxes in just over a week. August 16th is the week they go out. That's also when county officials will put out ballot drop boxes. So August 16th is the first official day of voting if you get your ballot in the mail by then.
Finally, when it comes to voter engagement, when you kind of tap into that, is that picking up steam? I mean, do you think a majority of people know that there's a recall, the date that it's happening, and are actually going to be motivated enough to go out and vote?
It's a really good question. I think that sending every voter a ballot will definitely help turnout. And I think that Republicans and people who dislike Newsom have obviously been very engaged on this recall, but this isn't new. I think this level of this disparity in engagement has been this way since probably January, with critics of Newsom, you know, really fired up about the recall, really wanting to get him removed. Democrats have kind of have written it off in previous months, and now that it's here, and they'll get a ballot, you know, sent directly to them, maybe they'll fill it out. But again, that's the one thing that Newsom and his Democratic supporters, elected officials, need to do is make the case to voters that they need to spend the time to fill out that ballot and send it out.
Going back to the debate last night, you sat through it all. Do you think it's going to make a dent with voters?
It's a really good question. I am not sure that anybody who has been tuned out of this recall sat down to watch the entire 90 minutes, especially if, you know, it was for Republicans and it was a very, some of the questions were really like Republican centric. We had questions on focusing on China, focusing on intellectual property theft attempts from China, focusing a lot of time on critical race theory being taught in schools. These are things that are, you know, important, or but a lot of independent and Democratic voters maybe don't care about, especially as much as wildfires and whether their kids are going back to school. I think the fact that they spent more time talking about China than they spent talking about going back to school and masks in schools in a few weeks here says something. Hmm.
Do you have a podcast coming up this week?
We do. And it'll be a lot more recall coverage and analysis. We're talking to two former recall campaign veterans to, you know, kind of get their take on the recall news this week, the debate last night, and maybe share some war stories about what's different between this recall and the last one in 2003.
Oh, I'm sure you got a lot of material to go through for, from now until the recall election day.
Yeah, it'll be a fun episode. So tune in tomorrow 3:30 on Friday afternoons on Cap Radio and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Okay, and that is California State of Mind. Nicole Nixon is the podcast co-host, and she's also, of course, Cap Radio's politics reporter. Still ahead, the Tokyo Summer Olympics is coming to a close. We take a look at the highlights and powerful moments outside competing with a local journalist who's covered the past 10 Olympic Games. You can join the conversation too. Just email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez, and we're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's kind of crazy how fast time flew by for the Olympics. I mean, we waited a whole year for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, and the final days are fast approaching. Sunday is the closing ceremony. But in what feels like kind of a time warp, a lot happened. A lot. And it's not just the gold medals, the world records, and the extraordinary athleticism that we come to expect, but athletes reminding us that they're human, just like the rest of us. And arguably, that may become the bigger legacy of the 2020 Summer Olympics, postponed until 2021. With that, I feel like I just chatted with our next guest, who has been watching the Olympics pretty much unlike the rest of us, KCRA anchor and Olympics reporter Deirdre Fitzpatrick, my former colleague at Channel 3, joins us now for a recap. And for a recap of the recap-y, Deirdre joined us to kick off the Olympics last month, affectionately called Fitz. She's covered the last 10 Olympic Games with photographer Mike Domalog, and that is 20 years. This was the first Olympics watching from home. So with that, welcome back, Deirdre.
Hi, I've watched more television in the last 2 weeks than I've watched in 20 years.
I can imagine.
I've watched it all, like every moment of it, I think.
You know, we already know how little sleep you get while working the Olympics on location. I'm going to go out on a limb, given that you also work the morning shows, saying you probably didn't get caught up on a lot of sleep loss from the past 10 Olympics.
No, that's for sure. And it's funny, you know, I've been basically working double shifts for the last 2.5 weeks. So the joke is like, I don't know what time it is. I just know that at 4 a.m. and 4 p.m. I'm expected to be on TV with makeup on. So that's truthfully been the hardest part. It's having to get, and you can remember this, getting dressed and ready and, you know, doing all the makeup and the girl stuff. Like, it's just, that's the part that has been the drag. The rest of it I can handle. It's just the hair and the makeup twice a day is a lot.
I feel you. What I really love about the Olympics is that you don't really have to be a sports nut to become invested. I mean, you can learn about the athlete or the team as they're competing. You kind of dip in and out and still become emotional when they win or even when they lose. I mean, I found myself tearing up at so many moments.
Oh, I know. In fact, I would argue that it's better if you're not a sports nut, because it's really more about the people and the backstories and the countries and the underdogs. And that's what kind of gets you sucked in, vested over the 2 weeks of the games and the Paralympics as well. And I'm not a sports reporter. I'm a news reporter. So I've always covered the Olympics from a news perspective, but with a love of sports, if that makes sense. So yeah, I agree. You get so dragged in and so vested, and you start to relate in unusual ways to some of these athletes. And definitely Simone Biles opened up a conversation about mental health that clearly is long overdue, but she has gotten families talking about things that they weren't talking about. And after this last year and a half, it's been really interesting to hear how many people are saying that they're talking to their kids in a different kind of way. They're talking to their friends in a different kind of way. And they're acknowledging some of their own shortcomings and challenges, because she so publicly has dealt with her challenge of mental health on this stage.
And it's so important to remind people of the background of Simone Biles, because she's like the superhero, right? Like the greatest gymnast ever. And you forget that, you know, she came out of foster care. You forget the failure of the U.S. Olympic team in protecting her and more than 100 other gymnasts from Larry Nassar and sexual abuse, that she's 24 years old and that she's human. I mean, that all gets lost sometimes with the phenom that she's become as the best gymnast of our time.
Yeah, you know, you forget that she and her sister at very young age were in the foster care system, and her parents, who you see on TV, are actually her grandparents. So her biological mother had a lot of struggles. And so her grandparents eventually were able to step in and to raise the kids. And those are the two that you see on television all the time. And then as a teenager and as a young woman, to have gone through the sexual abuse that she did at the hands of people that all the adults in her life trusted with her at a very young age, and under the leadership of USA Gymnastics, incredibly traumatic. And she has been the remaining face of the last Olympic team in Tokyo. And that was one of the things that she said really brought her back to the Olympics, was the fact that she didn't want people to forget that everything had happened. And she was a constant reminder, not only to the sport, but to the organization that failed her, that she was going nowhere and that things had to change. So USA Gymnastics has been completely blown up in that time, with all new leadership, new medical personnel, one of the team doctors is actually based out of Sacramento. She works for UC Davis Sports, Dr. Marcia Faustin. She's wonderful. And, you know, that has been a big part of it. So, you know, you look at what she was going through and the challenges facing her, not only the fact that we all were kind of counting on her to win everything, you know? I mean, like the joke when they named the gymnastics team was, you know, it's Simone Biles and a few other people. And those few other people have become these, you know, wonderful stars of the game as well. And she has been there along the way after she admitted she needed to step back to cheer them on. And I think that's been one of those things that has been really great. And she's not the only one at the games to say it's too much. You're now starting to see people like Adam Peaty, who is a big star in Great Britain, saying, I need a timeout. And he has said that he right now is going to take a break, a mental health break after the games, because similar, having so much pressure on him the whole time, he's like, I can't do it anymore. And Caleb Dressel has come out and said, even after winning all of his gold medals, 5 gold medals in Tokyo, he has said that the pressure was terrifying the entire time. And he's admitting it now, and he says he's going to stop lying to himself. So it's quite a gift that she has given other athletes and herself in stepping back and saying, I need some time and I need to take care of myself. And I really believe, and I believed it the first day when she came out and was talking about, you know, how she had to step back. I really believe that's going to be her legacy. It's not going to be all the gymnastics. I mean, it'll still be there. But I feel like, you know, 20 years from now, we're going to say, she's the one who changed the dialogue. And she's not the only one. Michael Phelps certainly lifted the lid on this years after his struggles with the documentary that he put out, The Weight of Gold. But I feel like these young athletes are changing the narrative of not only their sports, but the Olympics in general. And they are controlling the narrative right now. And that's a very interesting development, because it has never been like that in the past. And they're showing that they are very powerful individuals in their statements that they make about social inequity, their statements they're making about mental health, what they will and won't do. And they're being listened to. And I think that's pretty amazing. Hmm.
I imagine that bronze medal that Simone Biles won, just it has an invaluable meaning behind it, you know, given everything that we just talked about.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, there's symbolism in everything.
Right.
If you have enough of these facts in your head, there's symbolism. And if you remember back to Rio, the only other medal she won in Rio was bronze in the beam. And she always says people would talk about her as, you know, this four-time gold medalist, and they wouldn't even mention the bronze, like it didn't count. And it did count. And to her, it did count. And to come back in the beam and to get a bronze again and to say that that's the one you're most proud of is powerful. And I think that she's showing that bronze is golden just for different reasons.
When we're talking about Simone Biles, you know, coupled with Naomi Osaka, who's 23, she put mental health before tennis tournaments, before the Olympics. You have track superstar Sha'Carri Richardson, 21. She had a withdrawal from the Olympics after testing positive for marijuana following her mother's death. This is all raising larger conversations beyond sports. Is there another Olympics that reminds you of this?
Not in that way, per se, because I would say 10 years ago is when I started hearing about sports psychologists being assigned to every single team. But the truth is, those sports psychologists were there to give you a competitive edge, not to keep you mentally whole. So that's where the big change is. And that's why this is so incredibly different, because in the last year, with these athletes being stuck at home and not having access to travel and their regular training regimes, they were sensing, the USOPC knew how much they were struggling. And so they were doing weekly check-ins. They had a 24-hour hotline available for athletes who were struggling, some of whom have said they contemplated suicide. And they've had, for the first time ever, mental health officers on the ground in Tokyo. Now, when they started taking all these different precautions, it really had to do more with the letdown that most Olympians say they experience when their athletic career ends. Because they get to the end of their career and it's like, okay, now what? You're the highest of the high and you go to the lowest of the low with a big question mark of what comes next. So that's really where the mental health initiative came from. But in the last year, it completely got flipped because of just the current pressures that athletes and the rest of us were facing. And so things change. And now you got to think that this is changing for good. You're looking at the athlete as a whole person versus everything else. And they do, just like our kids in school, they have completely different pressures than athletes from yesteryear had. And the social media presence of having to be a brand and on at all times is immense for all of us, but especially for people who have that much attention and sometimes money tied to their performance.
What kind of impact, this kept crossing my mind, what kind of impact do you think waiting a whole extra year to compete and not having an audience had on athletes?
Huge, huge. And I've seen gymnasts especially say that it's normal to feel that excitement, that pressure, that doubt when you step up to competition at that level. The thing is, an audience can get you through it. You know, I mean, like when you've got everybody cheering you on, sometimes you can put that other stuff on a shelf and you can dig deep. But the quiet of that room, of not having people, many of the athletes have said that that was a real problem. And actually, Lori Hernandez from the 2016 team, no, Allie Raisman said she felt that at the Olympic trials in St. Louis, they should have taken one of the nights and not had fans there to give the athletes the opportunity to find out what it would be like to compete in silence. Because competition is different than practice, and they turn it on for competition. So they all have said that it is very different. And that's why, like in swimming, you started seeing all those teams showing up for each other. I've never seen so many team members show up for the opposite sex or for, you know, their other team members. And they became their own hype section because they needed it.
Yeah. I also feel like there was just really a focus on female athletes and their power, their strength, even their boundaries. I mean, I love that you have young women, barely teenagers, dominating, like skateboarding, you know, swimmer yeah. Katie Ledecky winning gold for the first women's 1500 meter. I didn't even realize that women didn't compete in that. Allyson Felix, track and field. I mean, it's really, and I don't know if it's just me, but that's kind of, or what I'm just gravitating towards, but that's kind of an overarching theme I've been kind of feeling and watching this Olympic Games?
Well, and gender equity in the Olympic movement has been also a focus that they've been working on for the last couple of Olympics. So that's why you saw the addition of the mixed categories, like mixed swimming relay, mixed triathlon. It's kind of fun to see, like, how are they, how do they interact? How do they compete together? How are the speeds really different? But on Team USA, of the 600 and something athletes, it is more female focused. There are more women than men, I believe, for the first time. And I agree. I think the women, there have been more female stars of the games. We don't have a Usain Bolt anymore, but we do have some pretty amazing 400 meter hurdlers who are, you know, Sydney McLaughlin and, you know, Allison Felix. How can you not root for these stories? Mm-hmm. And there are some really strong people, and it is exciting to see them leading it and also leading that next generation, because there are so many teenagers who are there without their families, without their parents, without fans. What an amazing experience. And some of them have performed at extremely high levels. And part of it is probably they don't know what they don't know. They don't really know what they've been missing. But it's been really exciting to see how closely they've all worked together. And I know I interviewed a couple of swimmers, one of whom was a first-time Olympian, one was a second-time Olympian. And they said that the team got so close because they didn't have distractions of family and everybody else. So what a unique bond some of these teams will have post-Olympics for the rest of their lives.
When it comes to what the legacy of this Olympics might be, you know, the Today Show called this Olympics the Kindness Games. And there's such a specific warmth to it, given the past 17 months that we've all endured. Do you think that's maybe the legacy or one of them, you know, one of the themes coming from this?
You know what? I think that has always existed. I do. I've seen those moments right and left. We've just not paid attention until this year because the world is a little rough right now, right?
Yeah.
Life is still a little rough. We were told it wouldn't be rough right now, but you know what? It's still really rough. And so I think when we see those moments of sportsmanship, we are highlighting them because they mean a little bit more right now. And you're also not taking other shots in the stadium, so you're looking for them a little bit more. So I would hope that you will see more of that. But I loved in swimming when you saw them jump in the line to hug and to look up together. And you see how these countries interact because they all know each other really well. Because when you go to an international swimming competition, it's the same 50 people every single time. They all know each other. And so they are friends. And sometimes they have romantic relationships and long-term friends and best friends from other countries. And you never really noticed that, but I have noticed it on the track, the coming back, the grabbing the hand, the helping the person up. We are looking for it because maybe we need it a little bit more right now.
Yeah, we definitely do. It's kind of crazy to close on this. I mean, I did a double take when I first realized it, but the 2022 Winter Olympics is like six months away. Have you wrapped your head around that yet?
You know, our Ozone producer, Stephen Mellish, just sent me a note yesterday about it. And I wrote him back one word and it was hush. Hush. I just can't right now. Yeah. But I have started thinking about it. And I have actually met up with some of our US ski team members who were doing some spring training up at Squaw Valley. And it is interesting for those guys. I'll tell you, 6 months out, a lot of their endorsement deals and the attention has already been pulled away because of the two games being so darn close together. So it is a little strange to think about another Olympics in 6 months, and also the fact that it's being held back in Beijing again. So if you think any of the controversy about the Olympics is over, hang on. We're just about to start back up again. But first, I'm taking a vacation.
Yeah, a well-deserved vacation. Yeah, and 6 months just flies by, as we know, we're already in August. So when we see you back here in, or hear from you in 6 months for the Winter Olympics, you think you're going to be in Beijing?
I would be very surprised. I would be very surprised. I don't think so. But you never know. As my partner Donnie and I always say, until you're on a plane and you're heading over there and you're in international airspace, you never really know.
Deirdre, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Vicki.
Well, that is KCRA anchor and Olympics reporter Deirdre Fitzpatrick. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is CAP Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.